the knowledge of your ways. Direct our hearts to your worship. Forgive us so that we may be redeemed. Keep us from suffering. Satisfy us with the produce of the earth, and our dispersed gather from the four corners of the earth. And those who stray from your knowledge, judge. And upon the wicked, make your hand heavy. And may the righteous rejoice at the building of your house, the construction of your temple, the flourishing of the throne of David your servant, and the lengthening of the light of your Messiah, the son of Jesse. Before we call, answer us. Blessed are you, O Lord, who hears prayer. And that brings us to our prayer time tonight. And so do we have prayer requests and our praise reports? The car wasn't. The car's dead. I'm not buying another one. I'm not buying another one. We're just going to get by, aren't we, Jen?
I'm not allowed to crash anymore.
Not allowed to crash anymore.
Actually, I didn't know it was your fault.
Yeah, that was not your fault.
It's all about even. Bill took out two and June took out two. Jackie took out one big time. And
the times were not my fault. I've never taken an hour.
And let's see. Janelle jumped a curb and sliding on ice coming down off of Friendship Drive and slid. It was an awful day. She had a car full of kids, and they hit a curb hard enough that it busted both front tires. Slid out into 40, spun around into 40, and there was no traffic or anything in the midst of all of this, and drove it into the parking lot, and they all were sitting there shaking, waiting for me to get there. And nobody would drive. Nobody would drive. I had to drive this beat-up car home with the tires going, whoop, whoop, whoop. Had big baseballs on the side of it because it broke all the cords in the tires. And then Gina took out a curb up in Muskingum and bent the whole front end of her car up underneath. And then June and Bill both had accidents in New Concord. That's four accidents in New Concord that I can think of. Huh?
Wait, no, I'm technically in Norway.
Did I teach them to drive? And you know what? They've all survived.
That's what it's...
You know, we've had many blessings, and those of you that we didn't go into the story, June hit ice on a bridge over in Indiana and spun all over the place and pinballed off of the different parts of the bridge, took off the front end of the car, and a semi-truck just came past just as they slid off the side, and a second anyway, and all of these kids in this row, or four of them in this row, would be gone. And she got in a car accident the night before. So.
Out on a bridge, but mine wasn't that bad. My car's
fine. So God brought them all home safe. We are in Genesis chapter 50 tonight. We're finishing Genesis. Next week, we're going to start into our new study. And I haven't decided what the message is specifically going to be next week. I have about three different ones I'm tossing around. I told you I'm going to do this as we go because I'm just going to let the Lord lead me. I have an idea of all the different things we're going to cover. It's just I don't know the order they're going to come in. So we'll let the Lord kind of hand that to us. And it could be partly have to do with events in the world or whatever. We'll just ride that wave. And it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks, I think. It could be 12 weeks, but I think 6 to 8 probably is comfortable. I tell you this because you might want to bring a little notebook and a pencil with you. I'll do some handouts and try to give you some material every week. This is not something that we're doing flippantly. I'd like you all to, you know, walk away from this with a better knowledge of who the church is, of who Southern Baptists are, of who Shalom is, and what these other faiths are. You know, we're going to learn about the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Catholics and so forth. And we're not going to do, you know, a whole course on Catholicism. We could take a whole year doing that. That's not what we're going to do. But we're going to try to give you enough information of the basics that you can compare your faith to another faith. And some of the, I don't want to call them shortcomings, but maybe some of the stumbling blocks, because I'm a member of Shalom Baptist Church because I think we have the best interpretation of Scripture. As I've read it and I've understood it, and as others have read it and understood it, that's why I am here, and that's why we're not a Presbyterian church or a Methodist church. But that's not to say that they're wrong. It's just I feel that this is the best interpretation of Scripture. And we can work with them in many, many areas. There would be some things where I might have some contention. That's why there's so many different kinds of churches. I mean, if all the Baptists thought exactly like, we'd probably all drive to one place, you know, but we don't. We don't all drive up to Cambridge. Some of you are coming here. You know, and there's multiple Baptist churches in this area, and there's multiple Presbyterian churches. First thing I want to say is it's not a bad thing. It's like flavors of ice cream. You know, chocolate isn't worse than vanilla. They're different flavors of ice cream. It's all ice cream. But there's a difference between ice cream and manure. And that's one of the things we want to look at when we're doing this study, is we want to know the difference between ice cream and manure. Because there's some of those that are manure. And they ought to leave a foul taste in your mouth. So, you know, we'll look at those different good things, and we'll look at the things that, are differences that we don't want to be involved in. So hopefully we can through this whole process, you can have a peace about your faith, because that's what Shalom is all about, is about peace. A peace about your faith and a confidence in your faith that you'll feel stronger. That's why I teach the way I do, is I want you guys to walk away every week stronger in your faith, understanding the Bible's more real, the Bible's more true. I want that to pass every single week. And tonight we're in Genesis chapter 50. Bill, if you'd put up my first slide. And I'm actually going to read where we ended up last week, where we finished. And that was verse 33 of chapter 49. And it said, "When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people." And that's where we ended last week. And we start this week with, "When Joseph fell, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father." I want to tell you, I wish that this was more common between men. That's one of the things I'm so angry with homosexuals about, is they've turned every physical thing into a perversion and a sexual thing. Little boys used to walk down the street when I was a kid and they'd hold hands. And it wasn't a big deal. And now parents are worried about it because, is he showing homosexual tendencies? So on the one hand, society's out there saying, oh, it's fine, it's peachy, it's great. There's no problem with homosexuality. On the other hand, we're all afraid our children are going to be homosexuals. If it was an evolutionary thing, if you were born that way, guess what? There wouldn't be any. How do you reproduce? How do you pass on a homosexual trait? It negates itself. It's against nature and it's against God. And I'm sorry, but when I read this kind of thing and when I see stuff on television now, men cannot... David and Jonathan threw their arms around each other. They wept. They hugged. All this kind of stuff. It talks about them, how close they were. You know what? David had wives. David had several wives. David liked women. But yet there are professors in college, even at Muskingum, who will teach you that David and Jonathan were having a homosexual affair? Hogwash. Okay, so there I ranted. Now they're even trying to do it with little girls. You know? It's so now that the guys can't hold hands and the guys can't hug and the guys can't be interacting on any kind of level, now they're doing it to little girls. I mean, everything's becoming lesbian this and lesbian that. And you guys, you know what? Young ladies used to hold hands, walk with their arms around each other. Now if you see that on campus, what goes through your head? They're gay. And if your friends see you doing that, they wonder if you're gay. Okay, yeah, I'm done now. Joseph commanded his servants and the physicians to embalm his father. This is not a God-given thing here, the embalming, but it's not an issue. We could look at this and say, if somebody says, well, you should do this as far as burial goes. Guess what? We probably have already seen almost every kind of burial that there is to see so far in Genesis, including all the people who were buried from creation to the flood. Guess what? The whole world was destroyed. Don't worry about where your body goes, because all those people, they weren't all evil. Adam wasn't evil. Enoch wasn't evil. Methuselah wasn't evil. Now, Enoch was taken by God, but there's a number of righteous that grew up from Adam to the flood, and who knows where their remains are. So, I don't think God truly cares what happens to the body. He was strong enough and powerful enough to create it from the beginning. He can recreate it. He'll bring them up out of the ocean. All those molecules and atoms, they'll all come back together into the bodies that are needed. But this here, this was not the practice of Jacob. They practiced just burial, and fairly quick burial. But in this particular case, they're in a land far away. So Joseph directs his servants to take the body and embalm it because he promised Jacob that he was going to take him back and bury him in a different place. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it. For that is how many are required for embalming. And that would have been by Jewish practice. And if you want to know about embalming, then just go watch the mummy movies or something, because they're fairly accurate. I mean, they did all kinds of stuff to the bodies. They took out all the internal organs, and they like pulled the brains out through the nose and all this kind of stuff. They did all these things.
Are you done?
Yeah. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Now, I personally think that this is not something where the Egyptians were so moved by Jacob that they wept for him. I think this is an ordered type of thing. And they're telling us this to indicate how important it was. Normally, the time that you would mourn for somebody who dies is 7 days. The Jews sit Sheva. So if you've ever heard that, sitting Sheva, that's sitting 7 days. And they would come and mourn with the family for 7 days, and that was the mourning period. Now, granted, you would, as a personal person, you would mourn longer. You know, your wife dies or something, you're going to mourn longer. But this was like the official time period to show your caring. A whole week would pass by of sitting there, and you know, I don't think they just sat there and lamented, but it would have been a whole week of sitting and talking and remembering the individual, maybe writing things down to have long-term memories. When the days of weeping for him were past, and by the way, we've got 40 days of embalming. I have no idea if the 70 days run in, over top of that, or if they embalmed him first and then put him out for display and had 70 days of mourning. There's no way to tell. We know that of these two time periods, 40 days to embalm him, 70 days of mourning. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "I know I have found favor in your eyes. Please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. In my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me.'" And the translation of this may not be what we think of as in terms of actual, you know, him getting in there with a pick and shovel and hewing out his tomb. It's possible. But Jacob had servants. It's more likely the tomb I acquired for myself, the place I bought for my burial there, that's where I want to be buried. It would have a similar connotation to what's actually written in the Hebrew. So, I was looking at this as well. Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh. Basically, this is not like he's talking in the regal, you know, please speak to yours. He's not talking to Pharaoh and talking like in the regal, we and they and so forth. He's actually can't get to Pharaoh. As high placed as he is, there's still layers. And we don't perceive that as we're going through Genesis to this thing. It's almost like Joseph and Pharaoh are you know, neck and neck big buddies kind of thing. No, they're not. Joseph is highly trusted. He's highly placed. But he can't get through the layers to just walk in and see Pharaoh. He has to give a message. So he's given the message to Pharaoh. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father, then I will return. And Pharaoh answered, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear." So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went all of the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. So basically, everybody who is important. I mean, we have the older sons and so forth in Pharaoh's house are going. All of these different elders and leaders, the servants of Pharaoh. It says, only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. So basically, all of Joseph's, everybody, goes up. And it, I'm assuming if they left the kids, they left the wives. Something, yeah. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. You know, I got to tell you, chariots. Okay, this time frame of this is about I'm thinking it's almost 3,500 years ago. 3,500 years ago. To put that in perspective, chariots and horsemen, according to Scripture, chariots. What does a chariot have? Wheels. And what do the wheels turn on? Axles. How far do you think a thing with a wooden axle would go? And it would just fall right off, right? So what do you have to have? You have to have metal. And what kind of metal? Iron. Iron. Iron dates clear back to here. The reason I'm bringing this up is I was watching a Food Network thing the other day, and they were talking about, you know, they put their little scientific facts up, you know, and 3,000 years ago they were using flint knives, you know, and I'm like, they had metal. They had iron. I mean, why would you use a silly flint knife? You know what? Every time you use it, it's going to break. Something else is going to break off. You're sitting there chipping at it. You know what? And while iron is hard to make, there's other things that aren't as hard. Copper. You can make a knife out of copper. It'll work. It'll work just fine for most purposes. Brass works just fine. Either one of those things are easier to make in lower melting temperatures than iron are. They've been around for a long, long, long time. Copper and brass and iron. And not only that, but they've found glass shards and stuff. And glass, I think I've told you before, glass is much, much harder to make than iron. It requires a temperature of 2,000 degrees for 24 hours to take those basic materials that you would make in glass for primary glass making, to make that. And then after like 24 hours, this sudden melding occurs, and all these things, the structure all changes. But you have to heat it for that long period of time at a fairly level, very high temperature, and you cannot get 2,000 degrees with wood. You have to have like charcoal. You have to have something like that, and a bellows. So they have found indications of glass clear back to this time. I could show you, I have a book that has a picture of a beautiful crystal plate that they found in the tombs down south of Jerusalem, and it's dated to 100 B.C., 100 years before Christ. They were making things. It looks like you could walk in, I swear, you could walk into Elder Bierman and pick it off of one of the shelves, you know, with the fine crystal. It's a beautiful plate, and they've absolutely dated it to 2,100 years ago. But that primary glass making is dated back as far as this. So, no, I don't think they were using flint knives 3,000 years ago. Gina.
When was Pompeii?
Pompeii was 79 A.D.
Okay, never mind. Because I think they had glass.
But it's right around that time. Corey.
One of the things that started the wars between Rome and Carthage.
Uh-huh.
Carthage knew how to make glass, and Rome didn't, and they wanted to figure out how. So they went and killed them.
Well, I have a book. The book is called The Glassmakers, and it is a investigation of looking for the signs of glass making. Because if you know what it takes, then there's certain archaeological signs that are left. You know, the charcoal. You've got to find, if you're going to have any kind of large amount of glass making, you're going to take wood, you're going to burn it down to make charcoal. So you're going to have, you know, large amounts of wood and big fire spots and things like that they're going to show. You have to have primary materials. You've got to have the right silicates. You know, you've got to have the sands and the different chemicals have to be present. And they found it all over the Holy Land. And this particular author thinks that the glass makers, as he calls them, were the Jews. That the Israelites knew how to make glass. That they had had this, I don't know if they learned it when they were in Egypt or whatever, but that's one of the reasons they were conquered so many times with different countries coming in and they got moved around, was because they knew how to make primary glass. That being said, secondary glass, which is blowing bowls and making dishes, that's not as hard. It takes about 1,000 to 1,200 degrees to melt glass the second time to be able to blow it and mold it. But that first time, it was like almost a magical thing. It was a guild. They kept it secret. They didn't let anybody inside to see what they were doing. They didn't tell anybody the secrets. And so they would be conquered and taken away. And this particular author thinks that that's why they were taken to Babylon. One of the reasons was, you know, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to have glass, and so he just took them. And they went up there and made it. And so it spread through the world. And as Corey said, you know, there was battles and wars fought over this kind of stuff. And they find shipwrecks today with ingots, about the size of a big coffee can, weigh about 20 pounds, of glass. And of course, that just lasts forever. And they find these big piles down where the shipwrecks were. hundreds and hundreds of these ingots where somebody had made the primary glass in this form, and it could be taken off then and turned into something else. So, mourning for his father for 7 days. The horse and chariot. They came to the threshing floor at Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. They lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. Now what you want to realize in this phrasing here, they crossed the Jordan, okay? So if we're looking at a map, which I don't have up right now, Egypt's over here, down in this area, and then Israel comes down through. And what you see is modern-day Israel, if you would see it on a map, there would be a dividing line between Israel and Jordan. That's the Jordan River, okay? So basically, they were coming all the way through modern-day Israel, across the Jordan River into Jordan, is where this is, where we're being told this is. So if you want to know what God thinks Israel's supposed to be, it ain't what's sitting there right now. Israel was supposed to be four times the size that it is. According to the 1920 Balfour Declaration, the Jews were supposed to be rewarded for their help in World War I, fighting Kaiser and fighting the Turkish Ottoman Empire. And many, many, many Jewish soldiers died in that war, which wasn't even their war. They fought in that war, they died in the war, and the world said, we're going to give you a homeland. You've been persecuted in Russia in the late 1800s. They were being murdered and killed. They were trying to leave. This is way before Hitler. They were trying to leave. And some of them had started going down to Israel. They were buying land in Israel from the Arabs down there. And nobody lived in Israel. It was abandoned. There was just handfuls of tribesmen. Nobody wanted it. The Jews were buying it, and the Arabs were laughing at them for buying it. They were buying this land, and the world said, we're going to give this to you. By the time we got to 1948, it was like one-fourth of what had originally been promised was all that was left, and that's what they gave them. And then that got broken up even more. And you know that the Arabs fought them over, and Israel ended up with this little teeny strip of land. That's all they had left. 300 million Arabs, 6 million Jews in a little teeny strip of land. Think we're going to have peace? They went up with him, both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. And when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. He set Sheva for Papa. After they've already had 70 days of mourning, so this is like the official burial that Joseph is doing. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore, the place was named Abel Mizraim, mourning or meadow of Egypt. It's mourning of Egypt. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. So Abraham and Jacob are buried in the same place. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. I wonder how many people that was. All for this. I mean, all the locals must have thought that was just amazing. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. Now, I like that. You know, Jacob didn't say that. He probably thought it, but he didn't say it. I don't think he felt like he had to say it to Joseph. I think he trusted Joseph. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? Now, you can take that two different ways. Joseph is not judging his brothers for what happened. Okay? He also, I mean, if we wanted to read that, just we could say, God will judge you. God will get you. That's not what Joseph's saying. Joseph's saying, don't fear. He's saying exactly what he says. As for you, you meant evil against me. And the reason I said that is because of what Joseph says next. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now, you know, I've been sharing with you old Jewish revelations, old Jewish stories and fables. And there are, one of the stories has to do with Benjamin. All the brothers have little stories after all of this transpires that as they come to their deathbeds, they all do basically like Jacob. And they all call their sons in and they have deathbed things. One of the things that touched me that I was reading, and again, as I said, this is not scripture. It's not in the Bible. It's just hand-me-down tales. Was that Reuben, the one who slept with his father's concubine, that Reuben completely had repented of that. That while he was basically almost cursed by Jacob, he had repented of that, called his children in and told them of what he went through. And that God had basically, according to this tale, God had punished him. And that he had almost died and his father had intervened with God to pray that, you know, that Reuben wouldn't die. And this went on for 7 months that Reuben was near death. And then it almost sounds like a sexual disease, frankly. I mean, the description they give in the tale. And then so God heals him and then he takes basically the Nazirite vow for 7 years. It says he doesn't eat anything sweet. He didn't eat meat. He didn't touch grapes. You know, he basically mourned for 7 years to try to get back into God's graces. And he told his brothers the evil that he had done, and encouraged them not to do it. And it went through that each of the brothers laid something out like that for their children, for their posterity. And one of the tales that I thought was interesting, in light of what we just read about Joseph and how he's forgiving of his brothers, was that Benjamin tells his offspring the true story that had happened, because Joseph had actually covered it up. Joseph told him told the truth, but not the whole truth. He told about how and Jacob had evidently been part of this to cover it up to the world, because it wasn't necessary, that Joseph had been taken away and so forth, and left the brothers out of the storytelling. And Benjamin did not know this until Joseph told him at his death the true story. The brothers knew, but Benjamin didn't know. Benjamin hadn't been there. Benjamin didn't know any of that. And matter of fact, I don't know. I don't think Jacob heard it, according to the story. I think Joseph had hidden it from Jacob. And all Benjamin had heard of what Jacob had told him. So Joseph, in all this, wasn't trying to be spiteful. And he wasn't being a liar. He just left the brothers out of the story, that they weren't instrumental to it. He forgave them in his heart, and he forgave them in front of the world by doing that. They were never held accountable for anything. Imagine how Pharaoh would have. I mean, Joseph could have just pointed at him and said, "Kill him." And Pharaoh would have executed them all. And he didn't. He forgave them, and he covered up their sin. He saw that they were repentant. So I thought that was an interesting tale to kind of show Joseph's heart, that he not only was he forgiving them face to face and personally, but in front of the world, you know, he hid their sin. He covered up for them and gave grace to them. Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And I thought that this was interesting. In Hebrew, it means were born on Joseph's knees. In other words, his grandson's sons. His grandson's sons, his great-grandkids, he was there when they were born. So he saw even them. And Joseph said to his brother, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, I want to read you a couple of paragraphs here that are supposed to be attributed. It's kind of tales about this, and then we're going to finish up. This talks about when the children of Israel left Egypt. Matter of fact, no. Let me do this, and then I'll jump back here, because we're going to jump right into Exodus. Because I wanted you to see like the end game, the finish of the story, because Joseph has just died. Okay. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Oh, I guess I picked up my verse again. Sorry. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. So everyone who was of equal, all the wives, all the brothers, everybody has passed away. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. And remember, Pharaoh gave them the land of Goshen, a large chunk of Egypt. Go over there because you got your sheep. We don't like them sheep herders. Go stay over there. And they just blossomed and filled the whole place. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So we end the study of Genesis. But after Exodus, when Moses brings the children of Israel out, one of the things they brought were the bones of Joseph. This is in Exodus. This is a tale to go with that, but it's so fitting that it could be true. During the 40 years of wandering through the desert, the coffin was in the midst of Israel as a reward for Joseph's promise to his brethren. "I will nourish you and take care of you," is what Joseph said. God had said, "If thou livest for 40 years, they will take care of thy bones." I said, "As thou livest, for 40 years they will take care of thy bones." At this time in the desert, Israel carried two shrines with them. The one, the coffin containing the bones of the dead man Joseph. The other, the ark containing the covenant of the living God. The wayfarers who saw the two receptacles wondered, and they would ask, "How doth the ark of the dead come next to the ark of the ever living?" And the answer was, "The dead man enshrined in the one fulfilled the commandments enshrined in the other. In the latter it was written, 'I am the Lord thy God.' And he said, 'Am I in the place of God? Here it is written, 'Thou shalt have no other gods before my face.' And he said, 'I fear God. Here it is written, 'Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain.' And therefore he did not swear by God, but said, 'By the life of Pharaoh.' Here it is written, 'Remember the Sabbath day.' And he said to the overseer of his palace on Friday, 'Slay and make ready,' meaning for the Sabbath." In other words, he told his servants, prepare. You know, prepare the food, because tomorrow is going to be the Sabbath. "Here it is written, 'Honor thy father and thy mother.' And he said, 'When his father desired to send him to his brethren, here am I,' although he knew it was perilous for him to go." In other words, back when the brothers took him and sold him into slavery, that this attribute says that Joseph knew he was in danger, but he went because dad told him to. "Here it is written, 'Thou shalt not kill.' And he refrained from murdering Potiphar when Potiphar's wife urged him to do it. "Here it is written, 'Thou shalt not commit adultery.' And he scorned the adulterous proposals of Potiphar's wife. "Here it is written, 'Thou shalt not steal.' And he stole nothing from Pharaoh, but gathered up all the money and brought it unto Pharaoh's house. "Here it is written, 'Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor.' And he told his father nothing of what his brethren had done to him, although what he might have told was the truth. Here is written, thou shalt not covet. And he did not covet Potiphar's wife. On their arrival in the Holy Land, the Israelites buried the bones of Joseph in Shechem. For God spake to the tribe, saying, from Shechem did ye steal him, and unto Shechem shall ye return him. God, who is so solicitous about the dead bodies of the pious, is even more solicitous about their souls, which stand before him like angels and do their service, ministering unto him. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you.